Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July the 30th, 1999. And in a fireside room this evening is Charles Anderson's The 20th Century, The Church's Biggest Mistake, number 99-1. Let's listen in.
My name is Chuck Anderson, and our topic for the next hour is going to be The 20th Century, The Church's Biggest Success and Its Biggest Failure. I don't know about you, but I have been thinking much about the millennium. In fact, I think probably I've been working on this talk for 50 years. I can remember as a small boy being fascinated by calendars and by clocks and by, as I grew older, causes and effects and perspective. And I worry a good bit, I think, now that our society may have lost some of that as it chases after single goals and single issues. And sometimes it doesn't seem that we have a lot of perspective and long-term things that we're working on. You won't be surprised, I think, that I majored in history at St. Olaf College and that probably more than half of my postgraduate work has been in history. You may not be surprised either that when I went to Norway in 1995, the most important place to go was Mosterhamn, right? The place where 1,000 years before Olaf planted the first Christian church in Norway. And that same year we had to be in Berlin on the 8th of May, right? VE Day, 50 years later, where every single church that we saw had a worship service. How many churches in our country had a service on VE Day 50 years later? And before that, when we went to India, where did we go? Where was the primary place? Guntur, right? Where Ziegenbalg, the first Lutheran global missionary, had gone 250 years later. Well, I'm kind of a crazy nut person. Some of you already know that, so we don't have to talk anymore about things like this. I worry a bit about the self-righteous arrogance of the topic tonight. It's my current least favorite sin, self-righteous arrogance. I've also learned, and this really gets scary, that people tend to become quite often like the thing they dislike most in other people, or they don't like in other people what they really like themselves. So I'm sure there is a good bit of self-righteous arrogance, or at least overstatement, in what we're going to talk about tonight. And to back away from that a bit, I respect your own ideas and will want to get to those after I finish, or in the midst of going through the list that I have for you tonight. And if we don't have time to finish all of this, catch me someplace during these next days and we can continue what I hope will be an ongoing conversation. I should say too that I make no apology for not having a particularly objective presentation tonight. I don't really think there are very many objective presentations on any subject. I think we all bring who we are to the table, and I think that adds rather than subtracts from most presentations, hopefully also tonight. It's going to sound rather Lutheran-like at times, and that's who I am, that's the perspective that I come from. And I would hope in the time that we have for discussion later, we can talk some about that, and those of you that come from other faith traditions can see and share with us if what we're talking about makes any sense to you. I want to pitch one thing as kind of an advertisement. I think the Peter Jennings Century series is absolutely superb. I don't know if any of you have happened to see it. It's a six series thing that's been on ABC. It was produced by ABC. There's also another 15 series one that goes on my favorite TV channel, the History Channel. But that's not, I think, quite as focused and delightful as the other. If you have a chance to see it, please do so. For instance, one session talks about Lindbergh's flight across the Atlantic and the moon landing. It says this is the very same story and plays with that. And the Vietnam War and the First World War is the same war. Just incredibly fascinating. But the one that blew me away was Martin Luther King Jr. and Elvis Presley. The same, really the same agenda, the same person, the same impact on society. So try and pick that up. Well, if we're going to be self-righteous and arrogant, let's really go to it and very quickly go through a few pieces, and we're going to stop probably more in this one right here, the church in North America. But that's up to you. See how it goes and interrupt if there are things that should be added and critiques, and we'll look forward to more later. Let's talk about the whole millennium. What is the church's biggest success and the biggest failure in this millennium that now draws to close? From 1000 AD to 2000 AD, I'm going to nominate or suggest as the biggest success global mission. Not that it started in the second millennium, there was much global mission that went on in the first, but it continued and it was a very dramatic movement in much of the second millennium. Lutherans were late in being a part of this process, not entering it until well after 1700. The biggest mistake that the church has made, in my judgment, is the whole series of crusades that took place over about a 200-year history from 1095 to approximately 1300. Misguided zeal, misunderstanding of what the reign of God is, believing that it is actually a place on earth. We've made that mistake over and over and over again, but I think not to the blatant degree that happened during the Crusades. We don't know how many there were exactly, at least eight, and at least four major Crusades. The one that is so tragic in 1212 was the Children's Crusade, when 50,000 plus children, small children, from what was then France, what is now France and Germany, went out, and at least the story goes, I don't know if this is true or if this is just an embellishment, that some of them were so pumped up and so zealous that they just started to walk out into the Mediterranean to their death in drowning. They believed that God would protect them and they could go and recapture for Jesus all of the lands that the Muslims had taken. Just a tragic thing, and of course, very few, just a handful of those 50,000 plus came back alive. You may or may not have heard that Christian pilgrims have now gone back to the Holy Lands, traveling through Turkey and into Israel to share words of apology for what our ancestors did. And I've got several fascinating articles up here. Not enough for everybody, but if you're interested in that, you may come up and look at this. I find it interesting, though, while Billy Graham has cut down, still I've seen occasionally the word crusade, but he uses that far less. Every Muslim knows deep down in the bottom of his or her heart that crusade was when Christians came in to pillage and kill and rape and plunder. And it's one of the enormous things that we have to wrestle with as we try and build bridges with our Muslim brothers and sisters. But in here, Christian pilgrims. Pilgrim is another label that probably we should be using less. Not helpful. to talk about pilgrims sometimes with our Native American brothers and sisters. So crusade and pilgrim may be words that we'll need to look at in a new light. There's even one article that more or less supports the fact that the Crusades were necessary, because after all, the Muslims did it to us first, and we had every right to hit back. That's also here, just so you know that I'm not giving you totally a party line tonight. All from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Let's move more quickly into the millennium, though, because that's really what we're here to discuss. And we're going to talk just very, very quickly and briefly about a couple other things to kind of gain perspective about several items. I think we have five subtopics under 1900 to 2000 AD. Global first, I'm going to suggest the biggest success in the last 100 years is transportation. Roughly speaking, on average, not including air travel, and certainly not space travel, the average person goes 10 times faster in any mode now as was the case 100 years ago. And that has been helpful in getting information out, of course, and connecting people to other people. The difficulty seems to be, yet for us, it doesn't necessarily aid in our communication or in our closeness to people, even though we have the access to people. So it's kind of a fascinating thing to ponder. And I'm going to suggest the biggest mistake globally that we've made in the last 100 years is fouling our nest. Virtually every kind of poison and the stuff that we have done to our nest in the 100 years is going to be a agenda for us going forward. We live in Red Wing, Minnesota. We haven't the foggiest idea what we're going to do with the nuclear waste that now is above ground in storage tanks right in the floodplain of the Mississippi River. Totally safe, of course, obviously. I don't know, sabotage and tornado. We have those in Minnesota. I don't know what would happen. I just know that if you hear on the radio that the Prairie Island plant has sprung a leak, pray for us real fast, because we're 6 miles from that. The Western world. I don't know that we could come up with a greater accomplishment, success, than the information highway. I doubt it. And again, like the transportation being faster, this is an aid, a technological aid to communication. But I have not yet been convinced. It's my gray hair, I'm sure. I have not yet been convinced that more information necessarily helps communication. And I think we have to work on that and sort that out so we can hopefully channel some of the energy on into some of those things that are critically important, and that would be communication. And I'm going to suggest for the weakness and the negative for the Western world in the past 100 years, weakened institutions. I cannot think of any single institution today that is stronger than the institution was 100 years ago. I cannot think of one. You may want to ponder that as we go forward in the subject and what I'm saying gets boring, and come up with some suggestions for the time of discussion. The church, weaker schools. Of course, it depends upon how you measure these things, but institutions really seem to have had some difficulties. The global church, number three on our list. The global church. There you've got a clue on the blackboard or the whiteboard. What anybody know what that particular formula is a clue about? 8,000 equals 800,000 / 0 equals 8 million. It's the growth of the Eastern and Western Hemisphere in terms of the Christian population, and this is China. In the late 1940s, there were 8,000 missionaries in China. And when the communist takeover took place, the missionaries were chased out or killed. Zero missionaries for decades. When finally China was open to the degree that people could come back and take a look, zero missionaries, Christian population in China had gone up tenfold during those decades. It's just an incredible story. I shared some of these same thoughts in a meeting in St. Paul, Minnesota for the pastors of the St. Paul Area Synod. And at this point, at that particular meeting at North Heights Lutheran Church, hand went up, "I challenge your numbers." And I thought, oh boy, here I am. I'm in trouble. And it's been a while since I saw this in print. I'm not sure I've got the source for this. Well, what he wanted to challenge, this man, it turned out, spoke fluently two different Chinese dialects, and said, "I was just over there, and those numbers are way too conservative. There are. You'd have to add probably 50% to that 8 million number. That is the lowest number. So probably, according to him, it would be 8,000 equals 800,000. 8,000 missionaries, 800,000 members, zero missionaries, and 12 million members. I mean, let us not despair. We did nothing except pray for these people, if we did that. And, you know, we didn't think very kindly of the Chinese, but God was at work there without us and caused that marvelous increase.
Reminds me of the parable about the sower who goes to sleep not knowing, you know, what will happen at night, and then wakes up and there's the harvest.
Yeah, yeah. God has so many surprises for us. But there is a minus for the global church, and you can kind of figure out, because of the plus, what my nomination is going to be for that. And that's what's happened in the northern hemisphere, for the most part, where the church has declined. Europe and North America particularly. But generally speaking, the church is growing south in the southern hemisphere, in certainly in Africa, where several of us have been recently, seeing just explosive growth there in the midst of horrendous poverty and many hardships and great competition from the Muslims that are sending in money because of all of the profit they're making on the oil that we're buying and other people. And they have the government set up in a way that it's more of a theocracy in the way they think of things, and they're sending in millions of dollars to convert people to the Islamic faith, and we send in hundreds of dollars to support hardly any missionaries. Well, let's get to the Lutheran Church in North America. Here's where it gets a little sticky and perhaps controversial. I'm going to suggest, and here I will sound terribly Lutheran, that the greatest success of Lutherans in North America in this whole century has been Lutheran World Relief. Or, the other way of asking the question, what do these have in common? Kosovo, Nicaragua, Grand Forks, North Dakota, Rwanda, Sudan, St. Peter, Minnesota, North Korea, Macedonia, Albania, and Comfrey, Minnesota have in common. They received aid through Lutheran World Relief within hours after tragic circumstances fell upon them. Carefully nurtured over 50 years, Lutheran World Relief carefully crafted and connected to the people that were there. We had missionaries in most of these places. They were very helpful in finding the places where goods and services could be sent in and delivered quickly and forthrightly at low cost. It's just an incredible story, it is. And I wish somehow in its 50th year it could have had prime time story to tell to the nations, because at one time the United States federal government actually came and inquired about the possibility of using Lutheran World Relief channels to send its foreign aid. Why is it, they said, that we are not able to do that and you can do it? Now, some of you know that I'm still in recovery as a bureaucrat. Having served in the office of bishop for a while, I don't know what that seems like to anybody that's not been there or been in some leadership position where there are no easy questions ever that come to your desk. And every single decision and question that comes is, a lose-lose sort of thing. What would you have done if, in the 70s or 60s, whenever this happened, the United States federal government had come to you and said, we will channel, I don't know how many billions of dollars of goods and people and services if you will allow us to use Lutheran World Relief channels? Well, the decision was mulled over, and I'm sure there were many pieces that came into the decision. I'm perhaps oversimplifying it. They decided no, because they felt that with the dollars would come control, and the nurturing that had been going on here, people-to-people kinds of contacts, so that the rice would get to the proper people, that would erode eventually and we would lose a good thing. Now, what did happen, gradually, the federal government did support the shipping of some Lutheran World Relief goods. To the tune, I think the high water mark was $800,000 a year, which was a fair hunk of change. The shipping is real costly, as you know, to get containers overseas and whatever.
Chuck, I can give first-hand support to what you're saying. The tornado that went through Comfrey and St. Peter came within 2 miles of New Orleans, Minnesota, where I served. It went through at 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon, and I had a call Monday afternoon from Lutheran World Relief wanting the names of any parishioners who were affected.
See?
I was absolutely
amazed. Yeah.
And they were in Comfrey and St. Peter at work all
night. They were. And the theory is we go in as fast as we can, and then when CNN gets the story and it gets broadcast, we won't leave, but we will fade a bit, because that's a one-shot kind of thing when, all of the money comes in, and then it's kind of forgotten. Then Lutheran World Relief goes back again. $800,000, the high water mark, federal government, and they also gave away some of the surplus commodities that could be used. When the federal government decided in all of its wisdom that all of us were paying far too much tax and we had to save our taxes, one of the things that was cut in the last tax bill, and I'm sure you all noted how much savings there was in your tax bill, that was cut to $200,000. So it was cut from $800,000 to $200,000. And some of the more tax cut, the pro-tax cut people said, and I think there's a point here. If you Lutherans think this is such an important thing, you get all these people, you'll figure out how to come up with $600,000. That should be no problem for you. The problem is we haven't really done that, or we haven't done it very well. I can't, for my own bias, come up with any more dramatic or significant thing that we have done in the last century. The mistakes that we made are a little more difficult for me, and I'm going to give you four of these, and you can fight among yourselves about the four. I think these four are just enormous difficulties that have come upon us, and basically within the last century or a bit less. The first one, and I'll tip my hand so I'm true to at least what the topic says, even though lots of topics the speaker doesn't necessarily follow up, but I want to do that for you. I'm going to suggest for number one the language question. We've kind of forgotten part of that now, but the language question just tore us apart. And I'm not sure if it did to the degree in other denominations that it did in Lutheranism. first parish that I served in Walters, Minnesota, South Central, Minnesota, I came to a parish where that had been formed in 1917-18, right after or during the end of the First World War, when the pastor at the other church refused to baptize a baby using the English language and said, the baptism will not be valid unless it is conducted in German. The people fought over that, and the church divided. Enormous issue. We hung on way, way, way too long to the tongues of the people that came over from Europe. And lest we think we are beyond that, we aren't. Right now in St. Paul, Minnesota, we have one of the most rapidly increasing multicultural areas in the whole United States. We started, you know, pretty white, so it's still not to the degree of LA or whatever, but with 60 languages spoken in the school systems in St. Paul, Minnesota. And some of the young people in the Southeast Asian ministries that have been started are starting to say, we don't want all of the church's ministry to be in the language of our parents. And it feels like we're going to go through this same thing again. And then lest we think we're beyond this, what about the racist stuff that we still deal with in our language and the sexist stuff that we're still dealing with in our language that are turning off lots of people? And the bureaucraties that we all use, you know, LWR and all the rest that we're talking about. We're talking to ourselves and we're missing the connection with the people that we need to be engaging in conversation. So the language question I would nominate as one of the really serious mistakes that we made in this, and it's largely one of this century. The second one that I'm going to nominate is that we have placed in this century worship and education in competition. And it happened for all kinds of reasons. Some of them were understandable and perhaps even good. But gradually we have come upon the time when people, large membership churches are having to have worship and Sunday school and many sections of both. And we have people that refuse to give more than 1 hour on Sunday morning. In this century, we have really moved education into something that's kid stuff and worship into something that's adult stuff. And we are beginning to pay an extremely big price for that. The church growth people that I worked with in the mid-80s pretty much said, and I've checked this out lately and they say it's still true, that there is almost no evidence that a child who is active in Sunday church school will necessarily become a worshiping adult. There is almost no correlation, but there is a strong correlation, no guarantee, but a strong correlation that a worshiping child will become a worshiping adult. Pastors after pastor in our area have almost come in tears and said, how can we confirm a child that probably has only worshiped 12 times in his or her own life, whole life? What are we doing? It's an enormous question, and there are no easy answers to this one. And we can talk about that. I think there are some clues, but no good answers. Number three. We have somehow allowed, in the 20th century, the gospel to be divided in a whole series of ways, but I think one of the most serious is a personal and a corporate gospel, or you might say evangelism and social action. You might say the private or personal and the public. And we've had enormous wars between these people. It's the same gospel, for goodness sake. but we haven't allowed that somehow to stay hooked together. Both are essential. Both are critical. And we shout at each other and we label people. You're conservative. No, you're liberal. Not good labels for this sort of thing. I think it's far deeper, far more profound, far more deadly than that. Somehow the gospel has at least been divided into two very antagonistic parts in the minds of a whole host of our people. I can tell you in private about some of the church basement fights that I have refereed in my day. Number four, I'm going to suggest as a serious mistake that we've made in the 20th century, I think we have taken out and we have replaced the engine of the church. I don't know quite how to explain this, other than I think we have moved that motivating force, that which drives every word, action, deed, organization within the church, from one engine to another engine. I'm not saying we're giving up what I'm going to share are the two engines. I'm just saying it's the motivating, the driving force. And the engine that was in place, for lack of a better word, I'm going to say it was proclamation. And we have substituted the engine of care. Okay? Now, please understand, I'm not saying that Chuck Anderson doesn't believe pastoral care is important. That's not the point. The other part of my postgraduate study that was big other than history was pastoral care. What I am saying is that there are lots of caring organizations out there that do wonderful things. There's only one really place where there is proclamation. And unless our pastoral care somehow flows out of proclamation, I think we're going down the wrong road. Okay? Again, there are a whole host of reasons, I think, why this may have happened. And I'm going to suggest, at least for me, this is the biggest mistake that we have made in the 20th century. Changing the engine of the church from proclamation of the whole gospel to care, caregiving. And that, you can prepare your rebuttals while we move into the next little piece. Please?
Proclamation versus care.
Well, okay, I'll try. Let me give you a couple of examples first. I've had the wonderful privilege in my whole ministry of working with grand staff people, just marvelous staff people. Some of you know who some of these people were, and you will agree that here's one really lucky guy. One of the staff people that I worked with very closely was in a serious automobile accident about a decade ago. And as I made pastoral calls to this person in the hospital, and we chatted, and I noticed that as I left and we shared a moment of prayer, and I knew how to read this person pretty well, there was sort of an angry tearfulness that was there. So we probed a little bit, and the person said, you know, I've had, and I don't remember the number, something, I've had 40 pastors in here to see me. You are the second one that has offered prayer. Okay, so that's a clue. Another clue would be that, and there are at least two in the village that had to put up with me in the candidacy process that I've noticed. For a long time in my work, I worked in the candidacy process. In the mid-70s, the normal answer, the most common answer that would come to my question of a person coming, thinking about seminary, and I would ask, you know, what reasons might you have for thinking about ministry, either as an associate in ministry or as an ordained pastor, and they would say, I really want to proclaim the gospel, and then we'd talk about that a little bit, and they may be more evangelistically oriented or more social action oriented, and we'd talk about the importance of putting those both together. But that was the answer. As we moved through the 80s and into the 90s, the normal answer I would get, the average answer would be something like, I love people. People have many needs. I want to care for people. And my thought was, there are a whole raft of ways that you could answer your call in helping professions. So I was looking more for, we want to invite people, we want to work on justice issues, we want to proclaim the gospel, and then kind of argue about what all of that meant. I don't know if that gives you a little clue. Let's look a little bit at the pastor, the last one, and then we'll have conversation, and then we'll maybe have time, at least briefly, to raise the question, what difference does it all make? Does any of this inform our entry into the 21st century? The pastor. In the 1900s, the century that's just coming to an end, I would be hard-pressed to have as a stronger success than the training that we have. I have no doubt but that our pastors are trained better today than ever. And that's not putting down any of the profs that I had or that some of you may have had. The negative side to me, and I want to preface this a little bit by saying that many mistakes that I make in my life and that I see others make and society makes is not choosing evil over good, it's choosing good over excellent. I think many more mistakes are made in that way, and this is kind of one of those.
Say more about that. That's not clear.
Okay, maybe if I tell you what my minus is, that'll help, and then we can work at it. When I was ordained in 1960, I went to work in a small community, and I had a pastor's study in which I did my work. Sometime soon after I moved to Worthington, 8 years later, hardly any pastor had a study anymore. They had an office. Are you beginning just to catch a little of the clue that might go with this? Not saying that the corporate model is bad or that good administration is not an important ministry within the church. That's a good. But I wonder if we have thrown the and you can see my bias here, if we have thrown something out here that also is very valuable and very unique for the church. Because there was no doubt in anyone's mind, in the 60s at least, that we were ordained into word and sacrament, and our task was to be the theologian in residence, not only in this parish, caring somehow for these people, proclaiming to them, but in the community. That's still there. But frankly, I see it less. And when I shared this in St. Paul, there were tears, wanting to get back to what pastors felt was really the primary call of the church, rather than to be a CEO of a corporate agency called First Lutheran Church. Now, did that help a little bit? Yeah. It's helping us with our language issue to listen to the music a little bit, isn't it?
Chuck?
Yes?
Don't you think that that's been taken even further with megachurch? twist on CEO where you have to, it's also the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
The pastor has to become not only a business officer, but an entertainer.
Yeah.
On church growth, then you also have to be a marketer.
Right.
Yeah.
Pastor of church in my town wears makeup on Sunday mornings so that you look under the lights.
Makeup, sure. Look into the whites, yeah. Now marketing, you know, again, if that's inviting, I mean, that's kind of a neutral word for me. I could think of some good things that we could do to market, but I'm not hearing that in what you're saying, and I know that side of it too. Come on, rebuttals, comments? That was good, helpful, Jan. I think you're right. I think that's part of it.
Well, Chuck, let me make it even worse than that.
Oh, thanks a lot.
I think, you know, my colleagues, friends in the ministry are facing identity crises because, quite frankly, a minister of word and sacrament is not an honorable profession. No one, and part of that is the change of identity in the thinking about a sense of what it means to be a called pastor. People really don't understand what it is to be called anymore.
No.
I mean, basically, you are hired to
yep.
be this administrator and all of that, and predominantly your role should be the kind of person who helps people through crises
yep.
or whatever.
Yep.
But this whole business of ministry and word and sacrament, and I have many pastors who have said, well, you know, all this seminary stuff, all this exegesis, all the homiletics, and I don't have any time to preach sermons and prepare for sermons. That's very unimportant, and nobody really wants me to do that. So, we just flip the sermons off quickly. Who has time for that? Because ministry of word and sacrament is not central to the identity of being.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. What I think maybe for me, if I could point to one time when this became clear to me, and this is a long time ago, was when I had my door open and I was praying, and somebody walked in and said, "Oh, I thought maybe you were busy," and then proceeded with the agenda that they brought in. And after that, I would spend time with my door closed, and I don't think I ever felt, I always had a tinge of guilt doing that. But needed to protect that kind of time that seemingly was being squeezed out by people around me. Paul?
Well, I think I disagree with the last comment that was made, especially the part that said there's no honor in being a minister of word and sacrament. Because my sense, for myself and for many of my colleagues, is that it's central to our identity. And I sense from my people that it is clear to them for our church that if Sunday morning is not faithful, the church is faltering. And committee meetings rise and fall, and annual meetings come and go, and stewardship drives are what they are. But if Sunday morning is not nurturing us as a people, that's central. And which is not to say that our identity doesn't face stiff competition. Certainly, there's competition from every side. But I think that's broader than just for the pastor, that it is our identity as church that also faces stiff competition. And I kind of like to tweak you a little about what you would say is the greatest success and failure of the laity. Because one of the ways identity has changed is that church is I think, more strongly identified with who the pastor is, how well the pastor does, than it was for my parents and the churches in which they worship. Mm-hmm. That affects a pastor's life, but it affects the church's life more dramatically.
That's a good comment. I don't hear that as so much disagreeing is kind of reinforcing the need for word and sacrament, and you would agree, I think, that where that is eroded for whatever reason, then we end up in trouble. I think the pastor is still very critically important. At the same time, I could cite chapter and verse even just in this last month where I was in several congregations working on stewardship ministry, and it was the laity that carried the meeting. Clearly, it was the laity that carried the meeting. And one delightful story, I think I can tell this one without betraying anything, it's kind of fun. I usually start out looking at some demographic stuff for the congregation, and in this case, the congregation had a much higher than average worship attendance. And I was trying to encourage that and support that and affirm that. Their number, I can still remember it, was 34.9% of all baptized members in worship on an average Sunday. The average for the ELC is about 30. In the St. Paul Area Synod, we're 10% under that at 27. So I was giving them all this. And the lay chair kind of reached up in his chair and looked at me across the table and said, do you mean 65.1% absent on any given Sunday is good? It was just a wonderful conversation that came, and it came from the laity. So I think we really need to nurture these key lay folks that are out there. Other comments, and also you haven't taken me on the stuff I thought you would yet.
I like what you've been saying. So one possibility within the clergy, have we been going through an identity crisis, and are we coming back to the center? I think one thing I've been seeing is that we've been letting everybody else define what pastors are supposed to do.
Yeah.
I think maybe we're getting back to the point of saying no. I mean, we went through the period of time where in seminaries there was more emphasis being put on CPE than homiletics.
Yeah.
And it seemed a little, I mean, it was good, but
not excellent.
Balance.
Yes.
And then we kind of shifted into the corporate model. I started working on a CEO. Now we're kind of saying, enough. It's time to get back.
No, you give me good courage, and I see some signs of that, and I hope you're right. I'm still nervous about it, but let's hope so. Greg?
Well, I think when we look at now the next century, the laity is probably going to become more important in the church, and pastors are going to have to change their focus again to being more of a teacher again, because lay education is the direction that the teaching institutions in our country are going to. And with the advent of the internet and availability of information, the laity is going to become more and more educated again, and the pastors are going to have to be able to lead that. And they aren't always going to know more than the laity will on every subject. So while the pastoral people are going to be set aside for word and sacrament in the right and proper order as we've done over the years, I think they're going to have to be more teachers. And so this is going to be another shift, because they haven't had to do that for a long time, but the laity is going to demand that of them, that they try and stay ahead of them.
And they're starting to do that, and I think that's a good sign. And the whole way in which lay are called to ministries within the church, I think we're just in kindergarten on that one. Please.
I want to play with language a little bit here. Your comments about the church in North America, I'd like some discussion around the word sin. And how, when you talked about the church has made these big mistakes, how has the church sinned in the last century? How would you translate what you said? And where do you need to ask forgiveness?
And repentance and moving in a new direction. I guess very quickly, I think we need to play with these and other things, and I think probably there is some sin underneath all of this, and arrogant, self-righteous arrogance. and many more places where probably that is important for us. And maybe we need to do that and have kind of a catharsis and set it behind us and move ahead.
It seems to be rather gentle to say, well, you know, sort of missed the boat here. Well, you know, a lot of people have been hurt.
Yeah, no, I feel very strongly about these four mistakes. Sin, I'm going to have to ponder that. If that's a good way of describing that, perhaps I could come very close to that.
And would that change the four? I don't know.
Well, I don't think there's lots of agreement or even thought about what these things are. I've been a little surprised at how much this seems to resonate with a few people I've shared these kind of preliminary thoughts about this.
It seems like a sin to turn away somebody for baptism in the language they would like it in.
Yeah.
Could I take a stab at that?
Sure.
As individuals, we are aware that we have an old self, the self that we live out to justify ourselves. And often it is our strengths that become our idolatries, the way in which we prove our worth or justify ourselves.
Yes.
I believe the same is true of institutions, that they begin to use their strengths to justify their mm-hmm. existence. And when they start doing that, they begin to rigidify. They begin to use their strengths. I've gone to many pastoral conferences where we use our wonderful theology to cut to shreds other ologies.
Yeah.
And in a very arrogant way, we have the liturgy that most people in our community cannot really identify with, and yet we keep saying this is the way it's got to be done.
Yeah.
Because our theology, another way is that we say our theology has to be right, and I think our lay people are so afraid they're going to say it wrong that they don't talk to each
yes.
other about their faith.
Yes, yes.
When they don't talk to each other within the parish,
yeah.
how are they ever going to go out and do evangelism?
Yeah. Yeah.
So to have another evangelism program to pump us up to go out, but we don't even know how to talk to each other,
yeah.
to me, is the sin of the Lutheran Church. So what I see needed is exploring what does it mean to die in order to come to life mm-hmm. as a church.
Theology of the cross. Remind me of one of my all-time favorite hymns, 433 LBW. The Church of Christ in every age, beset by change but Spirit-led, must claim and test its heritage and keep on rising from the dead. Sunday night, hymn of the day. Jan?
Another word for sin is error, as in missing the mark. And I think that the church has missed the mark it's almost excruciating act of yielding to popular culture in order to keep its members or increase its membership, instead of acting as the voice of prophecy, the prophetic voice within a culture that is becoming increasingly secularized and
yeah.
having all the values. And it's somewhat, it feels risky to say that this because I know it could be interpreted so variously. I think that somebody from the Christian right could claim that he or she is speaking in the prophetic voice. And that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not
no.
talking about more dogmatism. I'm talking about, the easiest way to put it in shorthand would be Bonhoeffer's cost of discipleship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
What you've just said is that same shift of moving from proclamation to caring, which, I mean, I went to seminary because my pastor proclaimed, and it was so amazing to me that someone was willing to speak God's truth in my life, and then to be ordained, you know, 8 years later into a church who didn't want that. And I don't mean, you know, a raving feminist screaming from the pulpit, but who wanted somebody to just make everybody feel good. And the church was meant to be the community that was nice. And if you couldn't do that, then you were assaulted. I mean, about 5 years ago, I had occasion to gather some graduates from my seminary to meet with some folks at a Synod Assembly, and I called 8-8, and 6 of them had left parishes in shreds. And so I think one of the mistakes of the church is that there needs to be some, I'm feeling pretty impassioned, some kind of a redemptive process between clergy and the hierarchy of the bishop's office. Not that the bishop needs to move away from proclamation to care, but where is there... I felt so alone as a pastor. And I think a lot of clergy feel alone.
Yes.
And if you try to proclaim, people really step back from you and leave you alone.
I totally agree.
A bishop, my experience, many of the bishops I've known, is that they are afraid of that too.
Yes. It's true.
Afraid of what?
A proclamation. I mean, the bishop that brought me into the ALC was Nelson Trout, and he made me proud to be a pastor. Because he wasn't afraid to tick people off.
Yeah.
And he wasn't wanton to his response.
Now, I agree with you. And we need to work at that at a whole variety of levels. One of the frustrations for the bishop, I hope this isn't defensive, maybe it is you have some control or power over the people and their future calls. And it's really hard to play out those two sides. And we haven't figured that out.
I'd like to nominate another success.
Good.
And that is just to say, I think I hate to see the century pass without celebrating ecumenism. Ecumenism. You know, the current moment isn't maybe so happy. but if we look back 100 years ago and where we've come with Roman Catholics and the Church of England, it's you talk about clergy needing care. That I've got good and dear friends in the United Church of Christ and the United Methodist Church in our town, and we worship together and pray together, is a great source of strength, which is undergirded broadly. And I think among the laity, too, people celebrate that they're free to respect and honor the way their neighbors worship.
I agree. That was number 2 on the list of successes, and we didn't mention that. We're almost out of time.
Can I suggest another failure?
Sure.
And that's the whole area of stewardship and giving and talking about money. I think we've failed. to talk about it. And Jesus talks about it in his parables, but we don't preach it, and we don't talk about it as a people. We live in the wealthiest nation in the world, and what is our rate of giving?
It's 1.6 in the St. Paul Area Synod.
And it's not increasing in proportion to what our wealth is increasing. As we have more wealth, we hoard it even more. So I think we've really failed to talk about the need to give, both in terms of what it does for society, but what in terms of it does for us as individuals, how we are blessed to be a blessing, and how we feel that blessing and as we share with others.
Do you live in St. Paul?
Duluth, Minnesota.
Why don't you move to St. Paul? We need you. Okay, let's take 2, and then I've got a couple wrap-up comments, and then a little prayer.
I would invite you to carry this on for another hour on another night and talk about what you see are the challenges, both for clergy and churches and denominations and the rest of the world, and you know.
I was just going to do that in 30 seconds, but I'd be pleased for some more conversation.
I would say another one of the successes of the church is the ordination of women and people of color.
Yeah.
It's really brought, it's becoming almost hackneyed, but a lovely diversity and joy to many communities.
Even though we were slow, nonetheless, it happened, and it's one of the places where, in comparison with other groups nations that are still struggling with this, even within Lutheranism and other denominations in our own land, and even in some places where we might not have expected as much support for women in ministry. It isn't total, but it's gone better than what might have been anticipated in 1970. Yeah. What difference does it make? We didn't get to that, and we could do that some other time, perhaps. Let me just throw four things that I think are on our plate going forward. Really big time. They aren't maybe so much, some of them are church related, but the church needs to be at the table. The whole issue of individualism versus the common good, it's just enormous. I find a big challenge in uncompromising witness in the name of Jesus while respecting other religions and cultures to be just an enormously difficult thing for us. We do that very poorly, I think, and we simply don't know how. Mm-hmm. Shirley and I had the privilege one year of spending some weeks in Britain and with Muslim, Hindu, Jewish, and Christians, and how we did that. It was just pre-kindergarten stuff, but the whole Article 1, I don't think we have fleshed out Article 1 theology in terms of the whole care of land, for instance, and then a whole environmental piece. And we've got to be at the table, and basically we aren't in any serious way. Thank you. I want to conclude with what I believe to be one of the great prayers as we leave the century and move to a new century and millennium. Not my words, but attributed to Moses. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn us back to dust and say, turn back, you mortals, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, or like a watch in the night. You sweep them away. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers. So teach us to count our days that we may gain a wise heart. Turn, O Lord, how long? Have compassion on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, so that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad as many days as you have afflicted us, and as many years as we have seen evil. Let your work be manifest to your servants, and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and prosper for us the work of our hands. Oh, prosper the work of our hands. Amen. Thanks for coming. If you're interested in the Crusades,